Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of insects. Phil Pelletieri, University of Wisconsin Extension entomologist, our guest today to talk with you and answer your questions about what's bugging you. And if you do have a question, give us a call right now. The number, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, the number is 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And Phil, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
We, in fact, got an email earlier in the day, and I'm trying to remember who the email was from. Let me look here. It was from Phil. No, it was from Tom, addressing Phil, and wondering about a dragonfly. And he sent a picture, which is kind of nice.
So yeah, very nice picture. It was a dragonfly that has a very white abdomen and some brownish striping in the wings. And it was a good enough picture we could tell it's one that is commonly given the name a common white tail. It's a male because the females don't have that white marking. And it's from a family of dragonflies, the skimmers, which are it's probably the biggest family we have. And you see these in ponds and marshes. And it's kind of interesting because in this case, this kind of dragonfly, when they first emerge, they're in a juvenile state. They're not sexually mature. And they often will go a mile or so away from water sources, spend 2 or 3 weeks kind of maturing, feeding on mosquitoes and other things, and then they finally go back to the area where they become very territorial, which is kind of a common thing for dragonflies. And, you know, we have, just off the top of my head, probably about 45 species of dragonflies. There's a gentleman by the name of Mike Reese that has a neat website on both Wisconsin dragonflies, tiger beetles, and butterflies. And so if people want to take a look at that, Mike has some great pictures. And then there's an old book put out by Carl Legler and Dave Westover on the dragonflies of Wisconsin, but I don't think it's still in print because these guys were kind of doing it on their own, you know, mass producing it. But we've seen a lot more dragonfly guides in the last 10 to 15 years, which is neat because a lot of people, I think, have really started to appreciate what they're about when you can identify them.
You mentioned butterflies, and we had a butterfly guy on the program the other day who was heads the Butterfly Association and was really quite irritated about the spraying that goes on for gypsy moths, feels that it's very dangerous to butterflies and doesn't do any good in terms of knocking the gypsy moth population down.
Well,
I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
A couple things. I mean, the DNR does request an environmental impact statement in any area. And one of the things they are sensitive to, that if we have endangered butterflies or whatnot, they will not allow the use of BT. But I think the thing that people have to realize is that when the BT is used, it's a stomach poison. And so the insect has to be in a small caterpillar stage when it is used. And a lot of our butterflies have not emerged at that point or are not at that stage. So it really doesn't have as much of a broad spectrum impact as people might think. And, you know, this year in particular, the butterfly numbers, I would say, are down, but I don't think it has anything to do with the spraying. I think it has a lot to do with the weather patterns and you know, the heavy rains and whatnot that often promote either just downright mortality or diseases. It's interesting with gypsy moth. I have gotten a lot of reports of a major outbreak of this fungus disease, Entomophaga, that we see that is a natural control. And really was very happy to see that because, you know, we've had dry springs the last 3 or 4 years that allows the gypsy moth populations to really explode.
Yes.
And in a lot of cases, I think this Entomophaga, much like we saw in 2004, had a major impact at reducing the number of gypsy moths. You know, the trap catches will come in at the end of the year and we'll be able to compare, but I will not be surprised to see a major reduction because of this fungus disease. And so we do see these natural flows. Again, the amount of land that we spray for gypsy moth is just minor. And so there's plenty of areas butterflies can breed and whatnot unaffected. So as I said, I don't really see a long-term big impact on our butterfly populations when they're using these sprays.
Well, lots of people to visit with you. So let's go to the phones. And Chad in Spillville, Iowa, I believe is up first. Hi, Chad.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Great. Thanks for calling.
I got a question about wasps, hornets. Not really a general question, but it seems like I got a lot of them this year. It seems like more than usual, around the garage, in the garage. You know, you got your, I don't know, normal wasp. You got the little honeycomb-type nest. But then we also got the black, little fidgety, I call them more of a hornet. Then there's different colors. There's like yellow and black ones. And I was just wondering if there's a better way of keeping them out or if there's something that deters them or Mm-hmm. Guy just kind of stuck with them, any advice you could give on there, I'll take my comments off the air.
Sure. I mean, with all the different types we have, different kinds of wasps and yellow jackets are looking for different environments to set up their nests. And so that's usually what you try to manipulate. The ground nesting paper wasp use old rodent holes, so just literally filling those in the spring would work well. You see some of the Polistes wasps and whatnot either like to work overhangs, or right now we're starting to see a new one move in the area called the European paper wasp, which looks like a German yellow jacket, but really is one of these umbrella or Polistes paper wasp nest makers. And they often will get up underneath siding, or if you've got storm shutters, they'll get underneath those kind of environments. So again, in some cases, plugging that. In some cases, if the overhang is a big problem, honestly, putting some very loose netting up there so they can't get access to it and you can't see it. So there are more physical things of seeing what they're looking for and basically prevent them from getting access. Now, on the other side, you know, most of these things are really pretty docile if the nests are not threatened. So, you know, when I get a call about a nest up on a two-story house on an overhang, I tell people leave it alone. I mean, there's no reason to. On the other hand, if it's right out next to your front door, the problem there is as you're coming and going, you can disturb them. And then you'll probably have to spot treat. And I think the general rule we use is if they are outside exposed nests, the wasp sprays work the best. If they're going into some kind of cavity or something similar, I would use a dust. And in both cases, it's probably best to try to treat it in the evening when things are kind of quieted down.
All right. Thanks very much for that call, Chad. Appreciate it. And we got an email from Bob, who says, we have a cottage in the UP and are troubled by biting black flies in the summer. They may be worse after a wet spell. They're particularly fond of wet fur or wet skin. Any thoughts on controlling or repelling them? They don't seem to mind DEET. I was wondering about those old big stinkies.
Okay. Well, let's start with the big stinky, because that's not going to be worth the effort. The fly that is biting him, I'm guessing, is what we would call a stable fly. Stable flies breed in seaweed and other sources of organic matter, rotting hay, even grass clippings. And some people would refer to them as a biting housefly because they are about the size and color of a housefly. Yeah. Like to bite you on the ankles. They like to bite you when you come out of the lake because when you're kind of shiny surface, they seem to be more attracted to it. The problem with it is that they really do migrate big distances. And so it's not as if you say, well, you know, they got to be breeding in the backyard and such and such. There is an Epps fly trap that is used in livestock rearing facilities that is a pretty efficient catcher of that. I'm not so sure that's practical for your cabin. But it's basically a blue tarp. The flies are attracted to this big blue area, and they fall into a water pit is basically the way it works. I do agree that the DEET, these are kind of a quick hit-and-run type feeder, and so the DEET just doesn't have a chance to repel them before they're onto you. There is a person that sells a Treadknot deer fly card that you put on the back of your hat, and it's basically a double-sided sticky card, and when they land on it, they get stuck. And so that's a passive way of kind of reduce the numbers. When they really get out of hand, it's the time that you got to wear thick socks and, to be honest, put on the little mesh suits. I mean, as I said, there really is no easy way. And they don't even respond to sprays well. You know, for house flies, they like to land on things. So one of the strategies is you put an insecticide on what they would land on. Mm. But stable flies, by their nature, don't have any one area they congregate at. And so, as I said, they really have proven quite frustrating to manipulate, because there just is nothing they're doing that we can make much of a difference with. So.
And deer flies probably the same way then? Or?
Well, deer flies, there's a little more practical trap there. In fact, there's the horse pal trap that's manufactured up in Amarillo, Wisconsin, is an example of one that it's like a big black beach ball. And there's an inverted cone over the top. And horse and deer flies are attracted to that ball, and they fly upwards and get caught in the cone. And so you can buy one of these traps. It's just that the stable fly isn't attracted to the deer fly trap, and the deer flies are not attracted to the stable fly trap. And so, unfortunately, you have to know which of the two you've got. Deer flies, kind of the same thing. I mean, both of these flies are attracted to movement and are normally out patrolling, looking for something to feed on. In the case of the deer flies, it's usually on the edges of woods. In the case of stable flies, very commonly on the edge of lakes. I mean, we do see a lot of problems near water. Some of that might be a temperature issue. You know, they don't.
Yeah.
But people will tell you out fishing in Lake Michigan, they get bit six miles away from shore. I mean, they're out there too. So.
Well, Jenna in Spring Green has a question for you too. So let's go to Jenna. Hi, Jenna.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I live in a log-sided home, and in the last 3 weeks, I've had upwards of a dozen bumblebees in the house. And I've tried observing them to try to figure out where they're coming from. But once they're in the home, they're trying to get out. They kind of make their way to the windows or the screen door. And I know that they're beneficial insects, so, you know, I don't really want to necessarily harm them, but I'd like to keep them from getting in my home, and I just can't figure out how to keep them from getting in the house.
Sure. I'm real suspicious they have a nest either along the outside wall or in between a log spacing. And so I think you'd be better off on a nice sunny day. Just take a slow walk across around the house to see if you can see where the activity is coming from, because then it'll give you some hint on what to look for inside the house that you can plug. Are they coming down through a light fixture? You know, by nature, bumblebees, again, are more ground nesters, although I have seen them nest in old birdhouses. I've seen them nest in bird nests. But it's not normally their nature to nest on structural stuff. So I would look low rather than high. And as I said, with that in mind, the colonies are relatively small. You know, we're talking 2-3 dozen individuals. And it sounds like some of them are just getting mixed up, that when they're coming and going, some of them are filtering into the house. And, of course, once they're there, they're very confused and, you know, probably end up flying towards windows, as you say, trying to get out. But as I said, I think the secret here is trying to identify where that nest is on the outside, and that's better done from the outside, and then see what adjustments you can make.
All right. Good luck. Thanks, Jenna, for calling. Appreciate it. Kim and Lady Smith, we're on to you now. Hi, Kim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was looking outside my kitchen window, and I live a little off of the Flambeau River, and I'm looking at these little white floaty things. I'm like, well, that must be like little cotton seeds off trees or something. And then one time one landed on me, and here's this little real active bug connected to the white fluff. And I was just wondering if you knew what those were.
Well, it's definitely a woolly aphid. And if I go in what we saw last year, there is one species called a woolly alder aphid that is both found on maple trees and also on alder. It transfers to two different hosts. And the best way to describe it is it's kind of like a flying fuzzball, because it excretes these long white filaments.
Exactly.
And then if you see one land, you'll see it does have a pair of wings and six legs like it's supposed to. And that's what I think you're seeing, is just these alder aphids moving back and forth between plants.
Okay, because I do have some maples.
Okay.
Yeah.
Look at the underside leaves. You'll probably see some smaller versions there, some of the immatures.
Oh.
It's also sometimes referred to as a maple blight aphid, but I rarely see it cause much high enough populations to hurt the maples.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Yep. Thanks, Kim, for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Ben Murrins. I'm hoping you'll join me today for At Issue from 4 until 6. We'll start with a top news story at 4, and after 5, we'll talk about how leadership at work and home can change your life for the better. It is all At Issue later today, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you have a question for Phil as we talk insects with him, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Let's go to John in Madison next. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a problem with Japanese beetles.
Yeah.
In my and they mostly are attacking my ornamentals and my birch trees. I went out with something called 7 and sprayed it on there, but I would prefer to be able to just kill the Japanese beetles and nothing else. And I heard,
sure.
I saw something on the internet. It was hydrated lime or slaked lime, also called calcium hydroxide, and there was some recipes for using that.
Boy, I would be a little concerned that may be somewhat caustic. The one option I can give you on the birch trees, although the timing is not the best, but for large ornamental trees like birches and lindens and the like that they like, there is a systemic insecticide you can use, and the advantage here is that the systemic is poured in the ground, uptaken by the roots. Anything that lands on the leaves is not going to be affected, but if you eat the leaves, you will die. And so that's one of the advantages. The second one is that all these contact insecticides are relatively short-lived. So either you got to spray the birch tree 5 or 6 times during this 2-month period where the critters are flying. The advantage of the systemic is you treat it once and it will last. But the disadvantage is it takes about 2 to 3 weeks for the tree to pick it up and move it into the leaves. And so typically the suggested treatment time is more about the first week of June so that you're prepared for that first week of July when the Japanese beetles start to come. And the product that you will find at the garden store is Bayer, B-A-Y-E-R, the people that make the aspirin, or Bayer, some people would pronounce it. They're tree and shrub insecticide. And the directions will be, you put an ounce per inch circumference of the tree and you drench it into the ground. And as I said, it's a way of protecting ornamental plants. But it doesn't solve all the problems because you can't use it on fruit trees. You can't use it on raspberries. And the other thing you'll notice is for roses in particular, it will keep the leaves on the tree, but it doesn't translocate very well into the flowers. So they still eat the flowers off. So you're still forced to do some foliar spray. But as I said, if your concern is to be a little bit more targeted in what you kill, the advantage of the systemics is it will only kill critters that are feeding on the tree.
Thanks. I didn't know that. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And they really are just emerging here in the last week or so, haven't they? I started to see them.
The numbers are going to be impressive. up at Farm Technology Days up in Green Bay, that was probably the number one question that we get coming in. And they're just starting to take off in the Appleton and Green Bay area. But one of the things my colleague Chris Williamson, who works with turf insects and Japanese beetle, was telling us he was seeing populations that approached 75 per square foot in some of the golf courses this past fall. And I think this is related to the heavy moisture levels we had in August. It was good lush conditions, so that's good egg-laying time for them. And then no frost in the ground or very little because of the heavy snow cover. And so, as I said, we're coming into this And the thing that I have seen in the last 10 to 12 years when it's really started to establish is you get these pockets and they slowly but surely get bigger. So a lot of people are experiencing it for the first time. And the bad news about this is, most insects kind of come and go depending on conditions. My experience with Japanese beetle is once it gets bad, it stays bad. And we have not seen it. And in fact, even on the walk over here, we were seeing some of the plants on campus getting hit pretty hard. Right now, the linden trees in the west side of Madison, the whole tops of them are already browned out, and we've still got 6 weeks more to go.
Yeah. So, lots of bad news there on the Japanese beetle front. Phil in Hebron, Illinois has a question for you. Phil, hello.
Joyful mosquito season to both of you gentlemen this morning.
Yeah, you as well.
I want to talk about a little bit more beneficial insect, Phil. I used to be a beekeeper, and the alfalfa field next to me that's about 20 acres of alfalfa went into full flower this year, which really happens in ag anymore, as you know. I walked the entire field and didn't see one honeybee. Where are we at on colony collapse disorder?
Well, in Wisconsin, we really have not seen a lot of, in fact, I'm not aware of an officially diagnosed case. We came out of the winter with about 30% mortality, which is about normal for winter kill before collapse disorder. In general, though, I guess I've made the same observation with all kinds of solitary bees and whatnot in our flower garden in the backyard. They're the bumblebees are starting to pick up. But I've had this comment made to me by a number of people that in general, bees in general seem to be on the light side. And again, you just only wonder if it is something related to weather patterns. But the interesting thing is for people who have 3 or 4 colonies in their backyard and are used and understand the proper care for bees, those people are not having problems. And so the good news is, even though on a national basis it's still a big issue with the migratory beekeepers, is in general we're not seeing the mite problems and all the other things that make it tough to raise bees are still an issue. But as far as collapse disorder, it has not made a big presence in the state.
Okay, keep swatting those mosquitoes.
Yeah, and thanks for calling, Phil. And speaking of mosquitoes, there was a surveillance trap at Warner Park in Madison earlier this month. And what'd they collect, 20,000?
Right. Patrick Irwin, or Susan Paskowitz's lab, our medical entomologist, her students, and particularly Patrick Irwin, have been working with the city of Madison monitoring mosquitoes. In particular, they've been most concerned about the Culex mosquitoes, which are vectors of West Nile. But they also put out traps, and they've been evaluating things. And so, as kind of expected with the incredible rains that we had, we knew that was going to give us a big flush of floodwater mosquitoes, and it hit just before the big Rhythm and Booms fireworks display. Mm-hmm. And, comparatively speaking, 20,000 mosquitoes in a night where, even on a bad night last year in August after the heavy flooding rains, we were down in the few hundreds. And so
200-300.
Yeah, so it just gives us an idea of what kind of hatch you get. But considering how much water we've got standing out there, that really was quite expected. Since that time, the populations have subsided somewhat, but I think as everybody's experienced, it's still very difficult to go out in areas at dusk and in dawn right now. And boy, until we see this stuff dry up, and we're not, of course, you know, there's still so much standing water. In the scheme of things, you know, I call this normal bad. I mean, I'm used to this growing up in the state. These are not unheard of numbers that we see. This is the kind of thing we see when we get this kind of flooding. And, you know, whereas the last 3 years, basically, in the summer in particular, we have been unusually dry. And for that reason, the mosquito numbers have been unusually low.
Well, I tell you what, I usually water our plants, our outside plants, between 5:30 and 5:45 every morning. And I put on generous quantities of mosquito repellent while I'm out there, and then I come in and take my shower after doing the watering, because man, they're out there.
And the problem is they're hiding in that shrubbery, and by watering them, you're just kind of waking them up.
So. Oh yeah, oh yes. Rob in Mount Horeb, your turn now. Hi, Rob.
Hi there. Yeah, I wanted to ask a question on the emerald ash borer. You know, we have the traps that are out. I live in the northern edge of Greene County, and all. And are they finding any yet?
None. It will be a big event when we find one, because of the concern both from the DNR and Department of Ag. And in fact, I tease people about it, but you won't miss this opportunity, because I'm sure the governor will be addressing us about just, again, the way the state is going to be dealing with this. So, you know, I've heard a lot of false positives. I even get the emails, it's been found here, been found there, but officially no. And we would hear about it if it really was. There were specimens.
The other question on that is we have a lot of those ash maples. They're sort of like a weed tree. You know, they come out like sprouts and everything. Are they susceptible to it, or is it ash or mountain ash?
Mountain ash, no, because that's not a true ash. Basically, green, white, blue, and black ash would be the ones that we normally would expect problems with. So it's in the genus Fraxinus, and anything else would not be.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob, for calling. Jeff in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. How are you, folks?
Good.
Great. I live on the 28th floor of the Landmark building, and my front porch gets covered in a little mosquito-looking net, and it's thousands of them. And I want to have some idea how to get rid of them. I face the lake, and they usually come during the day, then they disappear at night, and then they're back during the day, and the last couple of days has been thousands of them.
Sure. You know, to be honest, the pattern is exactly the opposite as I would have expected, because I suspect they're a critter that we would call a lake fly. The family is Chironomid, and it is a relatively closely related family to mosquitoes, but they're not a biting midge by any means.
Right.
Very short-lived. They're always associated with water. We have the same problem here with Lake Mendota. And usually the problem is that the adults are so strongly attracted to lights that at night they're often drawn into buildings in incredible numbers. During the day, although they could be active, it has a lot to do with wind speed. They're not strong flyers, so usually if there's any winds of 5 to 7 miles an hour or more, they have to lay low. You know, they just can't get up in there because they can't fly against it. And so, you know, there really isn't a good thing other than, you know, we tease about this sometimes, but if you had a good strong fan, you know, that would honestly blow them away from a small porch or another area, because they couldn't fly against that wind speed. So that probably would be the most practical way of trying to keep them down is just to have direct some decent airflow in an area they're trying to congregate.
Right. How long do they typically stay around for?
Well, you know, there's numerous species. Most of the time, though, when you get one of these big hatches, if you want to think of it that way, it lasts for about 2 weeks, and then it tends to subside.
All right.
All righty. Well, thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And Sue in Baraboo, it's your turn. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I have a question about my honeybees.
Okay.
More specifically, the activities of drones. We have a hive that kind of got a little weak, and we've been watching it, and the drones are out. And this is something that I really haven't seen much of before, but we can find them in and out of the hive and even up by the house, and that just seems unusual.
Well, you know, one of the things, and I'm not the best bee person on the top, but, you know, when you see that many drones, it would suggest to me that the queen is not a good queen, that she's not fertilizing the eggs, and you're getting a high number of drones being generated, which is that's usually the sign that you see.
It is a slower hive.
Yeah, and as I said, it may just be that she's no longer laying fertile eggs, and so then again, it's kind of like the whole society falls apart as far as general activity. Because as you say, that's not typical of a good healthy hive, and as I said, that's what it suggests to me is that you've got a poor layer that's not properly fertilized.
Yep, we were thinking it might be time to push another queen. And then I have another quick question. Bees in different areas this year, we have hives that are maybe 20 miles apart from each other, very different colored bees.
Well, that really is a genetic thing. I mean, you know, do you know what strain of bee that you was when you bought it?
I don't off the top of my head, no.
Well, you know, the real dark bees are often referred to as German bees. And to be honest, it's a type of bee that was not well-liked by many beekeepers because they tend to be pretty aggressive.
They are.
But on the other hand, is now between the varroa mites and some of the other things, people start to think that they have some personal traits that are really good to have. Whereas, you know, the Italian bees and the Carnola bees, there are different strains. And so that's all it is you just have a different genetic group. And if in particular, the real dark, they may be Germans. And it's interesting, even with this colony collapse disorder, I've talked to a couple beekeepers who think that these German bees may be one of the partial answers because they are less susceptible to some of those problems. And again, it just has to do, I think, with the genetic differences.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Sue, for calling. Appreciate it. And Jerry in Argyle, it's your turn. Hello, Jerry.
Good morning, Larry and Phil.
Morning.
I called Garden Talk last week, and since then I tried to collect one of these critters and wasn't able to. I was able to get a better look at them. In my raspberry patch, where the canes have been pruned off, there's you can see the end of it. And I had something boring into the end of the raspberry canes, and I wasn't able to really. I saw like sawdust coming out the end, and when I dug it out, it was turned out it was like a. It looked like a bluish, either a fly or an ant. It kind of flew away or fell down pretty quick, and I wasn't able to find it again. But it looked like it was born in there and laying some eggs.
Sure. Well, to be honest, I think it's a bee, or there's a small chance it's a wasp. And what it's doing is utilizing the environment of that hollow pith, or to be honest, they dig through it. You know, there's a lot of things like leafcutter bees and whatnot that will utilize the equivalent of a straw in nature. So anytime you have a plant that has a loose pith like that, especially when you've cut and pruned it, they will kind of dig out that soft stuff. And in the case of the bees, they'll collect pollen, they'll lay their eggs, let their grubs develop internally. In the case of some of these wasps, they'll go out and catch leafhoppers or aphids or other little small prey and kind of do the same thing. Even cuckoo bees would somewhat fit that bright blue metallic makes me a little suspicious. So it is definitely one of those groups, not anything threatening to the plant at all.
Okay.
You know, they'll go down maybe 2 or 3 inches at best. But the vascular part of the plant is still intact. So, you know, they're not causing any problem there. And again, in general, you'd figure most of these critters are beneficial because either they're pollinators or they're probably predaceous on something that we probably would rather not have around, like the leafhoppers.
That brings up the other day, I have a piece of pipe, like 3/8 copper pipe that's used for hooking up your sink, the basin, and the water supply to the sink.
Yeah.
And I made that up to fit on my outside hydrant for a drinking place, and I had it was just laying around, and I was going to put it on the other day, and got it out, and it was stuffed up with something, so I got a piece of wire and was poking through there, and something came flying out, and then there were a bunch of fairly large pieces of leaf stuck in there.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of these things will provision whether leaves or use grass. In the case of the cricket hunters, which are great big wasps, I mean, they're literally stinging and paralyzing crickets, dragging them into these holes, and so. It's interesting. Different size holes will attract different size wasps or bees. And, you know, the same thing is used for orchard mason bee, which is one of the early spring pollinators, where people just will drill holes into logs, you know, about 3/8 of an inch in diameter. And as I said, if you start playing with the diameter of the holes, you're attracting different groups of bees or wasps that are using those kind of environments.
All right. Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jerry, for calling. And Sandra in Racine, on to you now. Hi, Sandra.
Hi. I have two questions. About a year ago, I got the name of an insecticide to spray to put under the eaves in the fall for cluster flies, and I haven't been able to find it yet. So I don't know if I've got the spelling correct.
Okay, what?
I checked Steins.
Well, it turns out, in general, they're using synthetic pyrethroids, which amount to about 90% of what I see on the shelf at the garden stores, the permethrins, the cyfluthrins, the bifenthrins.
Could you spell any one of those?
Well, what you'll notice at the ending of each one of these, it's THRIN. Now, the only one that you may want to avoid because it doesn't have the residuals, a very good product, but it just doesn't serve this purpose, is pyrethrin, which is the natural insecticide that's derived from chrysanthemums, but
right.
That's not stable in UV light. And so what they've done is chemically altered these things, and they have what we call synthetic pyrethroids, and that's the permethrins, the bifenthrins, and the like. So the Orthomax and the Bayer's Home Insect Control, all those things would contain the right product. The one thing you might see, though, is that the formulations that the pest control services use, same chemicals, but they're often microencapsulated or wettable powders. More the microencapsulated. The powders sometimes cause some staining problems, but the advantage is they last a little bit longer than the liquid concentrates that you would buy in the store and mix with water, just by the way they're formulated. And so somebody's really insistent. They want the top-of-the-line stuff. Then you're probably going to have to get on the internet and buy these chemicals, and one of the names is Demand CS. There's another product called Suspend. There's another product called Delta Methrin. But you will find that, again, things like the Orthomax and whatnot will perform for 2 to 3 weeks. I mean, they'll do a decent job. So I think you're probably given a particular product, but I think the active ingredient you're looking for is quite common and will be a lot easier to find. And I'll guarantee if you go to a Stein's or a Jung's or whatnot, they will have the product. In fact, again, I can't believe you can find a hardware store that wouldn't have one of these products there.
Well, yeah. I probably had it wrong or whatever. But, you know, I hate to use it, but there seems no other way. And after when winter comes in, then they start coming in and...
Yeah,
when you're not at the home for a while.
Yeah, for cluster flies, I would try to get that product on around the first week of September.
First of September,
And try to err on the high side, you know, the overhangs and higher on the structure. I wouldn't worry so much at ground level because the way they work is they kind of land and then crawl upwards. And so that's often what's sneaking them under the siding or up under the soffits and giving us the problem.
So when we get rid, when the cluster flies die down, then we have earwigs. And I've been putting cans of soda or beer or whatever out, and they go in there and drown. But I'm thinking, am I attracting more, or am I just catching those who are residents already?
No, I don't think you're attracting more. I honestly like fish oil a little bit better than the soda because they seem to be attracted to it. So an old tuna fish can works pretty well.
Okay.
They should start to subside now. I mean, the earwigs have been out for about 6-7 weeks, and normally by about the 1st of August, I see their populations go down. But they like it lush, and so we're having all kinds of problems. I mean, people are calling about their marigolds and other things. And, you know, when in doubt, when people tell me they're seeing things eaten and they don't see it, we start with the earwigs. It just bothersome, and they've been filtering in the Pelletieri household now. I average about 2 a day crawling in the bathroom or whatnot, and we escort them outside. And, you know, we always tell people, you know, that this coming indoors is an accident. They're not going to breed inside. They're just kind of a little creepy, and I understand how people don't like them, but it really isn't going to hurt anything.
Well, this is our place up north, and we're not always there, you know, so then it's left empty for a while. When you come there, it's like, whoa, they took over.
Yeah. Well, you know, they like to cluster in groups, and so if they find a sheltered place, you know, between a piece of siding or, you know, you get quite commonly I'll have people tell me their mailboxes, when they open it up, they're just filled with it. And, you know, at night they're running around, but at day they're looking for nice sheltered places to get out of the sun, basically. And so you commonly see them under flower pots, just all kinds of things. And as I said, at this time of the year, it almost looks like there is a nest of them. It's not a true nest, but they definitely do congregate.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Sandra, for calling. Ivan in Beloit, your turn now. Hi, Ivan.
Hi. Thank you for answering.
Sure.
I have a vine hanging over a walnut branch and falling over the lawn. I went out there, I was going to see what she'd clip it off. Well, anyway, the leaves are being eaten by some kind of a bug, and they're really thick and heavy and very active. I captured a couple right now.
Oh, I bet you.
Bronze-colored.
That's Japanese beetle.
Is that the Japanese beetle?
Yeah. Yeah, it turns out that, you know, it could be grape or it could be Boston ivy. I mean, almost a number of the vine things are on the top of the list for Japanese beetles to feed on. And so the timing's right. And as I said, I bet you, but they will not feed on walnut. That's one tree they're not going to mess with.
Yeah, they haven't touched the other. I haven't checked other spots. A lot of vines grow here like mad.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Should I do anything with them or just let them grow?
Well,
very active.
Yeah, the thing is, no matter what you do, there will still be plenty of Japanese beetles out there. And so, you know, where I have the problem is right now people growing raspberries because, of course, the plants are coming into fruit.
Oh, sure.
And that's very difficult to treat. And again, people with grapes, because grapes, they absolutely will fly across the county to feed on. And so,
it's that type of leaf, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks very much. Can you use these floating row covers or anything on?
For small stuff, it will work. I mean, physically to keep it off. And you know, we've talked before about the traps. They make you feel good, but they make it worse rather than better. I mean, there's been a lot of research to support that. So, you know, it's interesting that you find that the same plant growing in a shady area is far less attractive. You will find that they're very sun-loving animals. And so sometimes you can adjust if your plants will tolerate it, is your favorite things that they like. As they said, try to plant it in a more shady area and you'll see less activity.
On to Fritz in Fish Creek. Hi, Fritz.
Well, hello. I'm calling about ticks. And about 5 years ago, I never had ticks around my property or didn't know they were there. And so that's one question. Am I stuck with them now? And what is their life cycle? Because sometimes I find small ones, and is that just an immature wood tick or...
Okay.
Sure. Well, you know, both the deer tick and wood tick have a two-year life cycle. And when they hatch from eggs, they hatch into a little stage we call a larvae that prefers to feed on rodents and small animals. So most people don't get larval ticks. If they're successful in feeding, they molt into a nymphal stage. The nymphal stage of the deer tick would readily feed on people. Not so common with wood ticks. I have seen it, but it's quite unusual. And then in the adult stage, they all like large mammals, and so they're attracted in. You know, in a lot of areas of the state that used to have low deer populations, once the deer seem to move in, there is this relationship with wood ticks in particular, that their numbers go up. So again, 50 years ago in spring green, not too many deer, not too many ticks. Now people talk about, you know, one of the best places I know to catch ticks is west of Madison in Iowa County and whatnot, but there are tremendous deer herds. The deer tick is a relatively last 20 to 30 year phenomena. It basically claim to fame, among other things, is that the wood tick season normally was May and June, and by the 1st of July, things really subsided. The thing you have to keep in mind about deer ticks is there is a life stage, whether it's the nymphal stage or the adult, actively searching for meals anytime there's no snow on the ground. And so right now, it's the small stage of the deer tick that's out there. It's the one that is more easily overlooked. And we see in the relationship then more people get Lyme disease that is acquired in the middle of the summer from the nymphal ticks because they're smaller, more easily missed to think about. So you definitely got to keep your guard up. And in the big question again, now which county are you located in?
Door
County.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the good news is, you know, Door County has historically had very low numbers of deer ticks. There's a couple hot spots I know. I know up in Detroit Island, I've had some correspondence with people saying that they've had some problems there. But generally, it's been wood ticks. In fact, interesting enough, Door County in general has always been on the light side of ticks. I know I've talked to some DNR personnel who say, you know, they can go a year or two before they find a tick, even though they spend a lot of time outdoors. You know, their populations, I think I've seen dry, extremely dry weather, like the 88 drought was tough on tick populations. But in general, you know, in the winter, the snow cover and whatnot, I don't see them be as much affected by weather conditions as most other creatures.
Does a wood tick vary in size?
Well, yes. It depends on the life stage. Although, anytime you get a tick, if you want some help in identifying it, just send it to the lab. I'd be more than happy to look at it. You know, it's hard to describe. If you're used to looking at ticks, they're easy to tell apart. But if you're not, it's hard to describe people the kind of things we need to look at. And there are more than those two kinds of ticks. To be honest, we have probably about 15 species of ticks that have been found in the state. But most of them are pretty specific. You find one on rabbits. You find one on squirrels. As far as humans are concerned, there's really only about three or possibly four that I've ever seen.
And you have photos of them or pictures of them up on your website, don't you?
Yeah, on the diagnostic website I have in, when you go under the tick section, there is a comparison of a wood tick and a deer tick right next to each other. You know, the deer ticks tend to have kind of an orangish red abdomen, black legs, black head, black scutum. The best way to describe a wood tick to most people is that they look almost chestnutty brown in color. Yeah. They don't have that bright orange, and usually they have some kind of whitish or cream-colored markings. Immature ticks are more difficult. They don't have all those morphological features, and so, to be honest, immature ticks, until I get them under the scope, I'm not sure what they are.
Wow. Thanks a lot, Fritz, for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, and hearing just this last caller, Fritz from Fish Creek, reminded me to mention again that we'll be broadcasting from Door County, as a matter of fact, from the Peninsula Players Theater in Door County, next week, Thursday. That's July 24th. And you're invited to come if you're in the area. Fritz, I hope you can make it. And anyone else who's in the Door County area who'd like to come, why, please feel free to come. The show obviously starts at 11, goes to 12:30. Come a little early, and we can chat a bit and have a good time there. The Peninsula Players Theater is a beautiful new building. And if you're in the Oshkosh or Appleton or Green Bay areas, we've got shuttle bus with pickups in Oshkosh, Appleton, and Green Bay. We'll pick you up and take you right there. And for that, tickets, the number is 920-465-2502. That's 920-465-2502. And you can also get some information at our website, wpr.org/Door County. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. And following the show, we're going to Fish Boil. I am. Renee and Emily and I are going to the Fish Boil. A lot of other public radio listeners are, and you could join us at that Fish Boil as well right after the show. That's next week, Thursday. Now, back to some more calls here. Teresa in Oshkosh is up with a question, I believe. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I have a flower bed full of box elder bugs, and I know why. There's a silver maple tree near it with a lot of seeds, and they're in every stage, and literally hundreds of them. And my question is, are they going to cause any damage to any of my plants? Should I do anything or just let them run their course of eating the seeds and
be on their way? They won't hurt your plants at all. And the other thing is, you know, I'm just guessing with as much rain as we've been seeing coming through that they are eventually going to have the door shut by a fungus disease, because we tend to see box elder bugs do well when it's dry and not do well when it's wet. But you hit it on the head. A lot of people, when they see the bugs crawling all over their plants, they get very concerned. But usually you have to have seeds on the ground, because that's what this is a seed-feeding insect.
Yep.
And that's what they're doing, is feeding on the silver maple seed, and particularly box elder, but you will see them on silver maple seed quite commonly.
So don't worry about it. Just let them be.
Right.
All right. Great. Thanks.
Thanks for calling. And on to Dan in Highland. Hi, Dan.
Oh, I got a curiosity question. And on the vehicles, on any vehicle around, it seems like there's species from insects. And it's butterscotch in color and very small. And it's very, very hard to wash off. And I'm just curious if you had any idea what type of insect was doing that.
Well, it could be two things. I mean, generally, if an insect is crushed on your car, their body fluids are often what catch. The other thing that we see, there's been a phenomenon. I've seen honeybees do this. I've also seen lake flies do it, that they honestly do excrete their waste. And so we've had trouble in car dealerships when there's a honeybee producer close by and the bees are out cruising. They will literally spot up the cars with their waste. Or the same thing when insects are attracted to night lights, that lake flies and whatnot. When an insect first emerged from the pupal case, they often have this highly high protein content fluid in their body that they excrete. And these are the kind of the wastes that have accumulated over time. And the phenomena is very similar to egg yolk. You know, if anybody ever threw an egg at your car and you don't wash it off, the egg yolk will literally etch into the paint. Well, we've had the same phenomena with insect body fluids, that if you're not careful, they can cause some paint damage. And so, you know, generally, if you get a lot of that, it's a good idea to wash it off before it hardens too much, because, again, you may get some chemical reactions that will affect the paint itself.
Okay, and that answers, because I'm right next to a very large beehive.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, my next question is, what do you use when you're out in the woods yourself to prevent mosquito bites? And if you've ever heard of anything called thermocell, and I'll take my answer off there.
Well, the thermocell, for my friends that like to go hunting, it is held in very high regard. It's basically a little unit that has insecticide and has a little gas cartridge. They basically cause us to go in the gas phase. You know, it's heated and it comes off. And so it generates this little cloud of insecticide around you that is both repellent and will kill mosquitoes. And so, as I said, I've had a lot of very good reports, and my colleague Susan Paskowitz has done some tests with them, and they really do work quite well in you know, for people sitting up in a tree stand in the fall or bear hunting, that kind of stuff. And the other question was, I had missed.
What kind of repellent do you use?
Oh, the repellent that I use. To be honest, I have gotten to the point, even though I do use some DEET on occasion and the like, but I'm lucky enough to have one of these little mesh suits. You know, these, you know, bug off outerwear is the one that I have. And I know there's other similar suits that you can pick these up in a sporting goods. And I found, you know, when I'm out crawling around in a swamp or somewhere where the mosquitoes are just atrocious, that to me is the easiest way to do it. I just put this little suit on over my T-shirt and the like, and it has a little hood on it. And, you know, I often recommend this to people, you know, gardeners in particular, that, again, they're out in the garden every day. You know, to put all this stuff on day in, day out is just a bother. And as you know, you sweat it off and the like. Whereas this suit allows me to go out in these areas, even when the numbers are bad and the mosquitoes can't bite me. So that's a trick. And I often do recommend it to people, again, that do spend a lot of time outdoors, is just, you know, you can fold them up. You can put them in your glove compartment of your car. They're always available. When things really get out of hand, I just put that little suit on.
Well, now, Jim Packard highly recommends the mosquito magnet. His neighbor has a mosquito magnet, and he was telling me that he was out at 5:15 this morning walking the dog all around the perimeter of the lawn and didn't get a single mosquito bite.
Well, it's interesting. Anecdotally, I get people a lot of times calling me up and who have them and have been very, very pleased.
What are they, by the way?
Well, it's a form of the true mosquito magnet uses LP gas, and it burns it and basically generates carbon dioxide, among other things. And carbon dioxide is the number one thing to attract mosquitoes. As they're drawn in close to the machine, there's a little fan that literally sucks them in. And so you accumulate them, and you can catch tremendous numbers of mosquitoes. But the thing I think to keep in mind, at least the scientific tests that I have seen, suggest, although you catch lots of mosquitoes, that when they really get out of hand, to be honest, it's still not going to be
enough
to go in the backyard. And one of the tricks that I'm concerned about, the information, they say, well, it takes 3 to 4 weeks to really kick in. Well, if you look at normal mosquito emergence, when you get a hatch, 3 or 4 weeks later, they're dying of old age. You know, and so, as I said, the scientific tests suggest, yes, you do catch a lot of mosquitoes. They are far more efficient than most of the things that have been used previously. Susan Paskowitz in our department has done some tests where they put them in one person's yard and in the next. And the true acid test is what we call a biting count, where somebody gets out there, takes their shirt off, and you count the number of mosquitoes that land on their back. And what her poor students find is that the magnets don't control them enough when we get these heavy populations to make it bearable to go in the backyard. So, you know, I think, as I said, they definitely do work, but there are definitely situations that I question they're going to hold up.
On our patio, we have a brick patio, and if we put out our got a pretty good floor fan and turn that on and put it on and sort of aim it where we're sitting, that wind helps a lot.
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of utilizing the fans and the like. And, you know, even sometimes you can get these larger fans that sit up high and blow it. And as I said, I think it would allow people to spend a little bit more time outside when we get these bad periods like we're experiencing right now.
Paul and Slingers up next. Hi, Paul. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Two questions. First one is, my wife is having an infestation of small ants in the bluebird houses, which are mounted both either on metal poles or wood poles. And the question is, should I spray the inside with a clear, high-gloss acrylic? Or I've tried some insecticides around the about 4 inches on the vertical of the poles, and it doesn't seem to their intrusion. And then my next question would be, I've noticed fireflies, and they emit quite an amount of light for about a second, and I'm wondering, what is the chemistry that takes place within the body of that small insect, and what the with this chemistry, this organic chemistry, how much is lost? Is that a direct, like 100% conversion of retained, or I mean of latent chemical energy to light energy? is there no loss of heat, and could we replicate that? Has that been explored?
And
what has been explored?
Yeah, just a question on the bluebird house. Are they on poles, metal poles?
Oh, some are on metal and some are on wood.
Okay.
You know, there one thing you might consider is getting some diatomaceous earth or some other similar drying agent that you could dust in there that would really make it tough on the ants. And it's a semi-permanent thing and wouldn't pose the birds any problem. And so, as I said, there's also a silica aerogel, which is the same kind of thing. It's a silica dust that, as I said, I know the ants won't like, because what it does is it scarifies the cuticle on their surface and they desiccate. So, and it's not a true nerve poison when you think about most chemicals to use. So that might be my suggestion there. The firefly story, it has been pretty much worked out. It's an oxidation and reduction reaction going on with a protein. So it's basically regulated by an enzyme. It is extremely efficient. I think the figures are like 96 or 97% of the energy is emitted as light and only 3 or 4% is wasted as heat. They have utilized that technology and even utilized the genes that make that protein more as diagnostic tools. You'll see quite a bit now in some of the tests that have there, that basically if the test is positive, it lights up at luminescence, and if it's not, it doesn't. So it's been used there. I think part of the problem is again, the cost. You know, when you're talking about enzymes and proteins and the like, to take that the next step further into generating enough light for people to use, I don't think chemically it's works both expense-wise and the like is efficient. But back when I was a kid, Penn State University would pay you to send them fireflies, and they by the hundreds, they'd give you a quarter, a hundred, if I remember right. And that's what they were doing is elucidating this, is you know extracting the proteins and understanding it. And so again, and I always tell the kids when I'm out, you touch a light bulb, we know 90% of the heat is wasted is heat, but the fireflies, nobody ever burns their finger on a firefly.
No, they're kind of easy, and they're easy to catch. My daughter loves to catch them out in the lawn at night.
And they're having a good year.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Talking the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in. All of our lines are filled, so we'll go right to the phones and to Paul in Rhinelander. Paul, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Good morning. Or afternoon, I assume.
Yeah.
My question concerns carpenter ants. I've got about a 200-foot-long rail fence made out of cedar rails and cedar posts. And I noticed on occasion that the posts were loosening up. And upon further examination, I find the bottom buried part has been pretty well destroyed by carpenter ants. Well, I plan to replace them, but I was wondering if there's some kind of I could coat them with something or put something in the hole to keep them from eating up my brand new post.
Well, part of it is that I would assume that some of the water caused the wood to soften, and that's what they're taking advantage of. Because if you've got dry, sound wood, carpenter ants won't bother it. There are ways that they use borates normally, you know, to prevent this. But the problem is a borate in the bottom of a pole in the ground is going to eventually leach away. I mean, the water is more of your problem. So anything you can use to treat the base of the post to prevent water from penetrating it will also keep the ants out. And so, you know, I don't know if there's what kind of treated side, if you want to get totally treated poles, that, of course, would work. But as I said, you know, a new fresh piece of wood, they're not going to bother with. But once it starts to decay because of the water and the like, that's the kind of environment they're going to move into.
We had a fence, Qualine Fence Corporation, as a matter of fact, put a fence in for us and just recently. And they run a steel pole into the earth, actually. And then they've got the cedar itself or the wood itself routed out so that it fits over the top of the metal pole, and so the wood itself is just sort of like just basically right at the ground level. And boy, they're really sturdy fences, and I think that eliminates the problem.
Yeah, I mean, it goes anytime you have untreated wood of any sort in contact with the ground. It's just a matter of time before the rots move in. And again, that's the kind of environment I'd expect the carpenter ants. And now, although cedar is more resistant than many woods to that, it's just a matter of time before it eventually does get softened up. And that's what they're looking for. That's why, you know, I think we really made a mistake as entomologists to call them carpenter ants, because the vision I think most people get with that name is that they eat wood. And that's not what they're about at all. They're getting into soft substrates, and they honestly eat insects and protein and sugar and those kind of things instead.
Yeah. So good luck, Paul. Thank you very much for calling. And Chris in Columbus, you're up next. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Great show. I have a pretty large garden bordering on half an acre and a very wide variety of plants, everything from sweet potatoes to squash and tomatoes and okra and everything. Just wondering, with that much area, I don't want to use a whole lot of dust and spray and stuff. What predators can I buy and introduce to the garden that will, you know, tip the balance away from large populations of leaf-eating insects? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Well, and the problem is it's much more complicated than most people look at. You know, if you would list all the potential insect pests that you'd have in the garden, we could easily come up with 40 or 50 species and probably more if we really thought about it. And you figure that each one of those has its complement of four or five predators and four or five parasites, but they're not the same, you know. And so what you're looking for is a diversity of beneficial insects, and nobody sells that. I mean, you can get soldier bugs, you can get lady beetles and whatnot, and they all help a little bit. But what we always tell people is, naturally, we have all these things, assassin bugs and nabid bugs and the like in the environment. And so instead, what you try to do is promote the kind of environment that will keep these things around. And most of the time, this has to do, interesting enough, more with having, in some cases, things like Queen Anne's lace and things that some people might identify as weeds that happen to be very important sources of nectar for some of the beneficial insects. So wild areas, weedy areas, not necessarily right in the garden, but adjacent to it, would tend to promote those kind of things. And also, again, being a little selective in your pesticide use, using things like neem oil and other things that will not have an impact on the beneficial insects will help promote it. People would tell you that mulch that you would have would probably promote spiders and other things that over time, and ground beetles that will feed on cutworms. So those kind of adjustments, I think, of you know, understanding. And so, you know, what I always tell people on the organic side, you have to be a much better naturalist or scientist to understand these balances and the like. And as I said, so I would investigate promoting the natural native beneficials rather than looking at importing some.
And let's go to Jim in Oconomowoc now. Jim, hello to you.
Hi, I have another question about lightning bugs. I saw something very unusual last night. In fact, something I've never seen before, and the lightning bugs were really out, and they were flashing away. And then one of the bugs landed in a tree about 15 feet from me and glowed nonstop for at least 15 minutes, and I actually went in the house and went to bed, and it was still glowing faintly, but very apparent. Do you have any explanation? And I'll take my call off the air. Thank you.
Well, you know, normally different species have different flashing patterns, and that's how they utilize to attract mates. I don't know what that one was up to. You know, it doesn't sound like it was trying to attract a mate, because, again, it wasn't doing the flashing pattern. I'd also be a little suspicious it was a female, because typically females will land on substrates and kind of more answer when the males come through. But I agree with you. That's not the norm. But I don't think that's totally that unusual. I sometimes tell people that some of these insects that do these things metabolically, it almost seems like they're a mood ring. When they're happy, they stay glowing. If you disturb them, they stop. And as I said, so to me, it sounds like a content lightning bug. But maybe I'm reading more into it than I should. But
well, it's as good an explanation as any. Let's go to Daniel in Madison. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, I'm calling about, I think they're hornets, or they might be wasps. I don't know what the difference is. They have made nests on the umbrella on my desk, you know, in my desk, around my desk table. My wife and I were cleaning the table yesterday. I opened the umbrella after it had been closed for a long time. And lo and behold, there are nests right there, you know, which were not there before I folded the umbrella. And this morning, my wife noticed, I went to check myself, that there were some of these little insects flying around there, which I believe are hornets or wasps. Now, my first question is, can we get rid of them ourselves without being stung to death? Number two, we had a nest like this on the overhang over the desk last, I think it's about maybe 9 months ago, and we had somebody from some company come and destroy that nest and so on and so forth. I'd hate to be bitten by these things, but we need to use that table and that umbrella.
Yeah.
Sure. I think most of the time people can do that themselves. You know, for anything that's exposed that you can see, you know, they will sell these aerosol wasp sprays. Some of them will spray 15 to 20 feet, so you don't have to get very close to them, but you do have to know where it is, you know, and usually a 4 or 5 second shot of this spray will absolutely wipe a nest out. In fact, some of the stuff even is generated almost as a foam, so it totally coats the outside of the nest, and then over time it just tends to dissipate. It's a good idea, though, because during the middle of the day there are wasps that are out flying and foraging for food. So typically that's why we talk to people about treating them in after supper, 7, 8 o'clock at night, because most likely they're all will be clustered there and you can treat it and be done with it. So for most people, as I said, you can go to the hardware store and buy a can of this for $4 or $5 and that will be sufficient. Where it gets a little bit more ticklish is where you don't know where they're going, if they're going into a tube or a hole or something. And then just because the nest may be a good distance away from where that opening is, those are the type of nests that I would normally suggest to treat with a dust instead. You can use an aerosol spray just to get a knockdown, but usually the advantage of the dust is it's coating that entrance, and when they come and go, they will be exposed to it, and that's what will do them in.
Okay.
Can you tell me again what's that spray called?
Well, most of them will identify themselves as wasp and hornet killer.
Wasp and hornet killer.
And whether it's a hardware store brand or a commercial brand like Raid or Black Flag, but there are numerous types of things. And most of them contain a quick-acting, quick-knockdown type of insecticide. And some of them, there's even some that don't have insecticide that just have a foam to it. I remember my colleague Chuck Koval came into my lab one day, and he had a can of this, and he sprayed it on my shirt, and I had this big foamy thing, and I'm wondering, Chuck, what's wrong with you? And within about 6 seconds, it was gone. It was not even anything left back on it. But to be honest, this was a way of taking wasp nests out. And in part of it, sometimes it's even some of the propellants cause some freezing action and some other things. So there's quite a few things going on there. But as I said, most of these things are made exactly for that purpose. So you don't have to get too close to the nest, and they work almost instantly at knocking the wasps down.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wonderful.
Thanks very much for calling, Daniel. Appreciate your call. And we'll turn to Carrie in Green Bay next. Hi, Carrie.
Hello. If I have time, I'd like to ask about two different insects. We have a property on the Menominee River, and I saw an insect called, I believe it's called a boatman. I'm not sure if it's the proper name. It can be both, it can swim and be in the river, and it can be out of the river and fly. And
was it a big insect?
Yes.
Okay.
And it was very large. It was like 4 inches long.
Yeah, I think instead it was one of the giant water beetles instead, or it could have been a giant water bug. There is a critter called a water boatman, which is a whole, it's a family of insects, but they're small, they tend to have these oar-like legs that they use, and that's where the name comes from, whereas some of the big diving beetles in particular do have similar types of legs. But they're much bigger, and so just if it was kind of a greenish and hard shelled, it was either
it was brown.
Okay, well then it could have been a giant water bug. That's the biggest aquatic insect I know that we have in the state. They again have oar-like legs, but if you looked at the face of it, it has almost a beak-like mouth part because they are predators on fish and other insects.
I saw it attack a crab, and what it did was it stunned it, and it was dead within a minute, and then it sucked on it for like 2 hours.
Yep, that's a giant water bug. In fact, you know, for that reason, you do not want to handle one because...
And I was handling it, and that's what I wanted to know, is if it could harm you.
Well, it would be a very painful bite. That would be the best. I mean, it's not anything that's life-threatening. Although the person that made me an entomologist is Dr. Robert Dick, and I had taken his course just for fun and got so excited about insects. And he tells the story when he was in the Navy. He has a picture of a very large giant water bug that was caught in tropical areas that he was stationed at. And he said that the person that went to get it went out swimming and grabbed it. And by the time he got back to the boat, his hand was paralyzed from the bite of this. And his hand got very swollen, very painful for 2 or 3 days, even had to be hospitalized. And so, as I said, giant water bugs, they don't go out of the way to bite you. So you can pick them up from behind and whatnot without much problem. But you do have to respect that mouth, because if it bit you, you would only let it happen once.
Okay. You don't know what its name is, though.
Well, no, that's the name. If you were doing a search on giant water bug, the family name is Bellostoma, and it's a family. The family is called the giant water bugs. This one is probably from the genus Lethoceras, because that's the big one that we have in the state. There are other big ones in other parts of the world. And also interesting, if I remember right, that the eggs of these are eaten in some countries, because the males carry the eggs on the back, especially some of the smaller Bellostomids.
Hmm. Okay, the second bug was also very large, and we think it had just hatched out of the river. Its wings were, it was 2 weeks ago, and its wings were like all crinkled, and it seemed really lethargic, and it had big pinchers on the front of it.
It was a male Dobson fly.
Yeah, male Dobson fly.
Dobson flies, their larvae are called helgramites, and fishermen like them. They're great trout food. And the adult males have these incredibly long, scary-looking jaws, but they're harmless. They're non-functional, as far as I know. The females, both of them have very net-like veins. They're very primitive-looking, almost look like dinosaur insects.
Oh, they're really, really scary-looking. It kept trying to, you know, it seems literally aggressive, but it just had these little, it had big pinchers on the front, but they weren't.
Yeah, I said I'm not even sure that they have enough muscle system to the pinchers to pinch. As I said, they're just more kind of sit there. I don't know if it's for sure. It probably has something to do with mating too. Insects have some interesting things going on sometimes. There's a reason for everything. Sometimes we're just not smart enough to know what it is. But that's characteristic. The males have these very elongated mandibles, whereas the females, it's much shorter. So that's how you can tell the males and females apart.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Robert in Middleton, your turn now. Hi, Robert.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've always been fascinated by bees, wild and domestic, and I'm considering getting a couple of hives just for fun. But I'd have to give them a water source. And I'm wondering, normally I'd put BT or Bacillus thuringiensis in it to keep the mosquitoes down, but would that harm bees?
No, the strain of BT that kills mosquitoes will not affect bees.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Matt in Decorah, Iowa, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Thank you for taking your time to answer my question.
Sure.
Me and my kids do a lot of camping, and whenever we camp on the Mississippi River, we always have these bugs that whenever we go out onto these islands is where we camp, but whenever we're out on these islands and we have to go back and get firewood, our legs from our knees down just get bit up by bugs that we don't see, and even if you just layer your legs with bug spray, they still just kill you.
Now, give me a little bit more.
What are they and what can we do about them?
Yeah, I mean, give me a little bit more of what's going on. I mean, do these things get kind of weepy and itch like the Dickens for a few days, or is it like a mosquito bite?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's nasty for a few days. It makes camping miserable. We put salves on them, but there's just so much. They bite such an area. You can go in there for 5 minutes, and your whole leg is completely covered in bites.
But just the legs, not other parts of your person?
Nope, just mainly from my knees down.
I'm looking at two or three different things. Normally when people get into things like that they don't see and they react to, you wonder about chiggers, which is a little parasitic mite. But typically chiggers will often crawl up and get you in the waistband and whatnot. That's a classic thing of getting you where your socks are tight or where your waistband is tight.
The ground is sandy, if that helps at all.
Well, the other thing I was thinking of is no-see-ums, which no-see-um is big enough to see. It's a very tiny gnat. You usually find it in still areas. It often will breed on the edges of ponds and the like. So I could see islands potentially having that environment. If you were to look carefully, though, it is a little thing, smaller than a fruit fly, but a small gnat that will feed on you. And very characteristically, they bite a lot. But I would think that the bites would also be on your forearms and other parts of your person. I can't see why it would be below the
knees. Wherever we go to grab wood, though, you know, I'll be carrying the wood in my hand or something, and when I go down to pick it up, you know, the arm that goes to pick it up usually gets bit, too, but it's usually just the lower parts of your legs.
Now, do you ever play around with mosquito repellents and stuff to see if that affects it?
Yeah, we've layered our legs with different things. We've tried in the past three different brand name off sprays, you know, and different things. And then we've also tried putting peppermint oil on us.
Okay.
And it's not a weed either, because that's what I thought initially, but we walk back there and there's no weeds.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am part of one thing to consider, and this may again not be practical if you're canoeing and stuff, but you know, they used to use a powdered sulfur dust on socks and the like to get rid of chiggers. I mean, they just don't like it. And of course, sulfur is easy to work with, but it's not something you put on your skin. It's something that, again, you would dust on clothing. But I'm still not totally sure it would be chiggers. I mean, bird mites will do similar things, but there's no reason to expect you find a bird mites on every piece of wood you pick up in an island. I mean, that part just doesn't fit. So as I said, I'm a little hesitant to think it's purely chiggers, mainly because I can't see why they're only concentrating on biting you so low on your legs.
And they're little red dots too, all over.
Yeah. Would your insect outfit, Phil, work in that situation? Man,
well, that'd be interesting. The mesh is small, but to be honest, chiggers are small enough. You know, I know it keeps out, well, it probably would, because we've done some experiments of keeping out larval deer ticks, which are about the same size as chiggers, and we find that they are too big to get through the meshing on that kind of suit. So that would be interesting to look at if again, you put one of these little mesh suits and you could see a difference. So again, it's very much like the mesh you got on your tent screens. We call it no-see-em mesh, and that's basically what it is. It's a fine enough mesh that critters can't get through. But as I said,
that I can get at like a Cabela's or something.
Yeah,
like
usually
that.
A sporting goods store, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, and those are lightweight and small, and you know, if you're canoeing or whatever, they fit in really in a very small place.
Sure.
Well, I appreciate you know the help. It just makes it so miserable when you're camping out there, and it's the first day you go get firewood and you're dreading it now. We're going this weekend, and I'm like, no, I don't want to get bit up.
I would head right off to the sporting goods store and get myself some of those outfits.
Well, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Why go through all that misery? Jacob in Madison, hello.
I'm glad you can fit me in here. I have been inundated in this small garden terrace area that I'm trying to maintain with a new kind of aphid. At least it's new to me. That's kind of a cross between a mustard and a rust color, and the population seems to be tripling or quadrupling every day.
Now, do you have sunflower type plants or what?
They're on actually the milkweeds that I have for the monarchs are suddenly becoming covered from the top.
Okay,
but now they're spreading to the undersides of the leaves.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a milkweed aphid, and you know the reason I was asking a little bit is most aphids are relatively host specific.
Okay.
And the like, and the plant will probably tolerate it more than you think. And the other thing that I find about aphids in natural settings, if you give it enough time, beneficials will show up, no matter where you're located. So whether it's lace wings or lady beetle larvae or something like that. Now, in the short run, what you might consider is the insecticidal soaps that are sold, or you can. It's always riskier when you're mixing soap from the house just because I'm not sure what's in that soap, whereas if you buy the insecticidal soap at the garden store, and the advantage is it's a contact kill. It's pretty good on soft-bodied things like aphids. But if a monarch shows up and lays their eggs, there's nothing there left that's going to give you any residual. So it's kind of a selective material. But you may even have some pretty good success if you could just get some forceful stream of water and wash the little stinkers away, because aphids, even though they're quite prolific, again, you often find if you can wash them off a plant, they don't get back on. And as I said, so you use that as kind of a hedge until something, whether they get a virus disease or a parasite show up or something else comes in to knock them out.
Okay. These are much smaller than the usual lime green aphids. They're real tiny, and now they're just piling up on one another.
Yeah, but that sounds very much like, I mean, aphids come in a handful of sizes, but they all tend to be pretty small. But as I said, there is definitely a milkweed aphid that would fit that. I usually would describe it as a little bit more yellowish, but I don't think that matters. You know, the way they're feeding, it definitely sounds like aphids. And as I said, you know, it wouldn't surprise me 2 weeks from now they have just disappeared.
Yeah.
But the interim, I mean, what I'd be careful of is that, you know, if the plant starts to yellow, stunt, or wilt, that would be a sign that the aphids are getting the better of it.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much, Jacob. And Phil, thank you. Boy, the time flew once again.
Nice being here.
You'll be here in a month again. We'll do this all over.
Sounds good.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest, and we'll have him back for sure in about a month and talk with him again. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, we talk with the master gardener, Madison Area Master Gardener, Judith Wright Roselle, and also with Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. So we look forward to that and look forward to you staying with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.